For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Visit us online at faith.yale.edu. This episode was made possible in part by the generous support of the Tyndale House Foundation. For more information, visit tyndale.foundation.
The notion of humanity, human existence being in exile, fundamentally, I mean, that's an ancient notion, obviously, but it's a secular notion in modern times. And the notion that you, that in some way you create your own home out of what you know of home or what you remember of home. We must be rooted in the absence of a place. So what is it that roots you? I think all poets, though, experience the feeling of displacement that comes with perception. Life is the thing. Words are always a kind of displacement. And so the poet, I think, is always also at one remove from ultimate things. You gesture towards them, but you also, there's also a sorrow there because you don't ever reach them.
This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. To be a poet is to be in exile, says Christian Wiman. And he knows this personally. When he was younger than now, he moved 40 times over a 15-year period. He would come early to work as editor of Poetry Magazine to write his own poems, spilling line after line onto page from the driver's seat of his car. He told me he wrote my favorite poem of his, a poem called Prayer that we discuss at the end of this interview, just that way. And the writer that defined him as a young man was Simone Weil, who wrote in her book, Gravity and Grace, "We must take the feeling of being at home into exile. We must be rooted in the absence of a place." And I wonder if all poets are exiles. Does that make us all poets? The generalized unease and anxiety that comes with being human often leaves us longing for a home. And each of us imagines a particular place, a perspective, a people when we think of home. But it's always longing, isn't it? Especially in light of the fact that we're home to each other. That home is ultimately a relational reality built and maintained and indwelled with people. If that's true, then no wonder we long for home all the more. Because we long to be accepted, received, and loved all the more. And a recent theme of this podcast has been exile and migration. War correspondent Janine DiGiovanni offered perspective on the vanishing Christian population in the Middle East, losing the ancient culture that they've called home for so long. Biblical scholar Francisco Lozada helped us view faith through the eyes of the immigrant's hopeful sojourn. And today that continues, even as we consider the very meaning of home by way of poetry, by way of exile. Christian Wiman spent most of the 2020 leg of the pandemic curating a story about home using 100 poems, using prose from some of the most wise denizens of our species to narrate the tale. The book came out this month. And if you're interested in more, you can listen to Miroslav Volf and Christian Wiman discuss this project on episode 36 of this podcast. I asked Chris to come back on the show to read more of the poems he selected, talk about the connection between poetry and faith, and continue to examine the meaning of home through exile's eyes. You might think that's exactly the wrong way to consider home, but Odysseus would tell you different as he fights his way back to Ithaca. Moses would tell you different as he leads the Jews through the wilderness. Jesus would tell you different as he goes to prepare a place for you. And what other option do we have as wandering wanderers anyway? Always longing for home, always praying for, in Christian Wiman's words, quote, "those moments of mysterious intrusion, that feeling of collusion with eternity, of life and language riled to the one wild charge." Thanks for listening today and enjoy. Christian Wiman, thanks for joining me on For the Life of the World.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your latest volume is Home, 100 Poems. And this is a volume you mostly prepared during the pandemic, sheltering in place, but very much out of place from your normal mode of research. Tell me a little bit about your process. Tell me a little bit about how you collected these poems and curated them and the prose that was included.
Yeah, this is a companion volume to a book I did earlier called Joy, 100 Poems. And in that book, I found that I was really coming to a fairly clear definition of what joy meant or might mean. And in this book, the poems led me to, I mean, there are different ways of different facets of joy throughout that book, obviously, but it's a complicated word. I quote Josef Pieper in this book, Home. In the realm of primal language, I think all words approach tautology, meaning that we never get to a final definition. But in Home, unlike in Joy, the definition just kept dispersing for me. And I couldn't, at first it was very frustrating. There seemed to be so many definitions of home, whether it's a physical place or a language or a family or one person or a God or a heaven or what have you. And eventually I just sort of let go and let the poems speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. In the book, you call out the multifaceted, even evasive definition of home. Yeah, you say it's a house, a country, a language, a love, a longing, a grief, a God.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that evasiveness and the expansiveness.
Well, I think the word, it ends up meaning different things for different people. I mean, I was just talking about this with my undergraduate class this past week because we read a selection of poems about home. The word home, many people have sentimental, and I don't mean that in a negative way, sentimental associations with the word. It's where we feel comfortable. It's where we feel it. It's where we feel ourselves. But then there are a whole lot of people in the world who think of home as hell. And either they've never had one, or the one they had was terrible and they've never been able to build one. And so the book needed to contain that tension as well. Some people believe that we'll never have a home on this earth, that our home is with God. And that's a whole different metaphysical pull on the language in some of these poems. Some believe that it's only in language that people are able to construct a home. And that's what Joseph Brodsky thought, who was in exile from Russia. He thought that language really was the only homeland. So there are just so many different ways of thinking about that word, and they all have to do with what one has experienced personally. So the poem that opens this book is by Mahmoud Darwish, who's a Palestinian poet. And it really gets at the heart of what I mean by home, the definition of home being at once, it disperses in 1,000 different directions, and yet it is the sort of center of all language as well, of everything we think about. It's called I Belong There. I belong there. I have many memories. I was born as everyone is born. I have a mother, a house with many windows, brothers, friends, and a prison cell with a chilly window. I have a wave snatched by seagulls, a panorama of my own. I have a saturated meadow. In the deep horizon of my word, I have a moon, a bird's sustenance, and an immortal olive tree. I have lived on the land long before swords turned man into prey. I belong there. When heaven mourns for her mother, I return heaven to her mother. And I cry so that a returning cloud might carry my tears. To break the rules, I have learned all the words needed for a trial by blood. I have learned and dismantled all the words in order to draw from them a single word, home. That was a kind of governing principle for this book. I have learned and dismantled all the words in order to draw from them a single word, home. The word gets broken apart, first of all, deconstructed, and then reconstructed in different ways in these poems.
Yeah, it does speak to the capacity of language to create a home for human beings. That's the very humanness of it. I mean, dwelling in words, dwelling in language, this is something that poets is deeply intertwined with your vocation. Even listening to you read this first poem, I'm marked by the way that knowing and having read so much of your poetry, I'm wondering if you could comment on the usefulness, the purpose of poetry in approaching something like this, these core human elements.
Well, I think it has to do with that Pieper quote that I mentioned. In the realm of primal words, we are always on the verge of tautology. He says we're always on the verge of simply saying home is home.
Yeah.
And I think poetry is a way of pushing us beyond that, because that's not exactly what we experience. We don't experience tautology. We experience complexity of experience that for which we don't have words, and a constellation of experiences. And poetry for me, is the best thing I've ever found in my life for expressing that complexity. And so when I am troubled by a concept, I have found, whether it's with these two instances, joy or home, both of which are, I do find troubling concepts in my life, troubling in good and disturbing ways.
Yeah.
I have turned to poetry. It's been the same with the word God, which to me is also just a tautology. God is God.
Mm-hmm. I am that I am.
Yeah, looking at it through poetry is a way of inhabiting the word rather than defining it.
I love that. You know, I'm a big fan of epigraphs, and so I pay attention to what writers choose in their epigraphs. And in one of your recent books, He Held Radical Light, the epigraph is a really interesting one to me. Juan Ramon Jimenez, he says, "The world does not need to come from a god. For better or worse, the world is here, but it does need to go to one. Where is he?" And that is why the poet exists.
Yeah, I love that quote.
Why do you, a poet, exist?
Well, I think the poet exists to remind me that existence is not existence until it's more than existence, that we're always being called beyond what we're experiencing. There is an abundance in our life that life demands that we acknowledge and in some ways inhabit. I mean, you can't ever own it, but in some ways you praise it. And I think a lot of my students think of an explanation for God lying in the past because we're here. And what Juan Ramon Jimenez is getting to is that no, it's the abundance of life. It's the joy of life. It's the moments when we're super saturated with existence that make us then wonder about a God. It's a forward motion, not a backward. There's a poem by Jack Gilbert called Singing in My Difficult Mountains, and it's very short. It's in this home anthology, and he uses the word helot, which means slave. Helot for what time there is in the Baptist hegemony of death. So slave for what time there is in the Baptist triumphant or dominance of death. For what time there is summer, island, cornice, weeping and singing of what declines into the earth, but of having, not of not having, what abounds, amazed morning after morning by the yielding. What times there are, my fine house that love is. That's such a great last line, my fine house that love is. And it's a poem about that very thing.
Yeah.
Poets leading us toward God in this poem, love.
You also say that, and this is in the same vein, I want to develop this thought, to be a poet is to be an exile. It's the way you describe the vocation of a poet in this volume. I notice of the many interludes, the prose interludes, that you select between the poetry in this volume to create a conceptual space, almost creating a narrative or a journey, a sojourn through these many dwellings. I mean, here's Simone Weil from her Gravity and Grace. We must take the feeling of being at home into exile. We must be rooted in the absence of a place. So I want to begin by connecting the thoughts of place and a traveling place, really, because that's a theme that is present in many places throughout the volume.
Yeah, it's a not entirely, but it's become more pronounced in modern times, the notion of humanity, human existence being an exile, fundamentally. I mean, that's an ancient notion, obviously, but it's a secular notion in modern times. And the notion that that in some way you create your own home out of what you know of home or what you remember of home. We must be rooted in the absence of a place. So what is it that roots you? Well, for her, she wrote a book called The Need for Roots. It's tradition, it's language, it's a religion, but it's not a place. It's not a homeland. She was out of hers, and so many people when she was writing were driven out of their homelands.
Yeah.
And so that's a particularly modern notion. I think all poets, though, experience the feeling of displacement that comes with perception. It's like Yeats once said, if Maud Gunn this great beauty that he was in love with his whole life, if she had only turned her attention to him and reciprocated his affections when he was young, he says, I might have thrown poor words away and been content to live. And there's the distinction right there. I might have thrown poor words away and been content to live. Life is the thing. Words are always a kind of displacement. Yeah. And so the poet, I think, is always, despite Juan Ramon Jimenez's statement, is always also at one remove from ultimate things, or from you gesture towards them, but you also, there's also a sorrow there because you don't ever reach them. There's the end of Wendell Berry's poem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes a great pairing with that Simone Weil, because he is sort of an anti-modernist, and he ends his beautiful poem in seven parts, and it says, there is a day when the road neither comes nor goes, and the way is not a way but a place. And that is a very different notion. That's not the notion of life as simply a journey, but the notion that life and place can be coextensive. And that our lives really are completely bound up with an individual place in the world.
I wanted to ask you specifically about this, because it doesn't just appear in Wendell Berry's, the selection of Berry's that you chose for this book. When you choose to end your opening essay of the volume with those same words, you write this. Why this personal note in this most impersonal of books? Because, quote, one only reads well what one reads with some quite personal purpose. And because in a land of masks, certain kinds of candor matter more than ever, and because amid the miseries of separation and isolation, and though my life has been somewhat frantically nomadic, there are still days when chance and choice can coincide, and I look up from my work to hear a sudden splash of laughter and a pup's companionable yaps, and the way is not a way, but a place. Those words sound so deeply personal to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't. The intro definitely. I mean, these books, these anthologies that I do are very personal. I mean, I do them for personal reasons, but because I'm wrestling with the concept. But I say frantically nomadic. I've written in other books about just how nomadic. I mean, I once moved 40 times in 15 years. And I've lived in so many places, and I still feel myself very lightly to any place that I am. But I have a family with whom I'm very, very close, and we have made a home here. And so there is always this tension between my restlessness, which is spiritual and existential and has been geographical, and the pull towards security and a single place, people, these relationships, and enduring, durable relationships. And so that last paragraph that you read is really those two things raveled together. In my 20s, all I could, Simone Weil was the most important writer of my life. And that's the only notion that I could really hold in my head, that you had to be rooted in the absence of a place. But now in my 50s, I feel a little differently. I still love Simone Weil, but I appreciate very much the work that someone like Wendell Berry has done to secure an existence against all the odds, secure a kind of existence in one place, and make language, make it out of language as well.
What I hear when you say that the younger Christian Wyman is seeking to be rooted in the absence of a place, and the Christian Wyman now is, well, there's this kind of stabilizing, perhaps, or a kind of attention to the ways in which the place and the relationships that make that place are, in fact, it's not an absence, it's a presence.
Yeah, this is from a letter that Van Gogh wrote. For all that, people still persist in thinking that life is flat and runs from birth to death. But life, too, is probably round and much greater in scope and possibilities than the hemisphere we now know. I think one of the great, people feel crushed by time, and a lot of modern people feel crushed by it. And there's a sense of just this sort of frog march toward oblivion, and you're sort of losing the sense of the cohesiveness of life. And Van Gogh is getting at the sense that things recur in our lives, they connect, and the movement is more fluent and circular than we realize, not flat and linear. This is the Bachelard, Gaston Bachelard, in the Poetics of Space. Poetry gives not so much a nostalgia for youth, which would be vulgar, as a nostalgia for the expressions of youth. It offers us images as we should have imagined them during the, quote, original impulse of youth. Primal images, simple engravings, are but so many invitations to start imagining again. They give us back areas of being, houses in which the human being's certainty of being is concentrated. And we have the impression that by living in such images as these, in images that are as stabilizing as these are, we could start a new life, a life that would be our own, that would belong to us in our very depths. So that's the part that you're talking about. I think about constructing a kind of space that you can grow out of. He's probably coming out of Heidegger. Heidegger mm-hmm. thought that language was mm-hmm. could give us a place to dwell in, that could make the earth a place in which to dwell. That was the function of poetry. And Bachelard is coming out of that, I think. I think there's actually more power than, I don't think it's a simply a nostalgia. He says it's a nostalgia for the expressions of youth. I actually think that it's not nostalgia. I think there's some real element of the past, of memory, that is made alive and volatile and even salvific in the present. And it's not an image of youth. Mm. It is the actual thing being brought into the present. And that's what I think Van Gogh means by the circularity. So I actually think that poetry is more powerful than Bachelard is saying here. I think it has more metaphysical power. He makes it seem almost like an illusion.
Mm. You know, here I want to appeal back to He Held Radical Light, because you speak of the seeking, quote, those moments of mysterious intrusion, that feeling of collusion with eternity, with life and language riled to the one wild charge. I wanted to ask you, you know, is this as much about faith as it is about poetry? And when you speak about the metaphysical capacity of poetry to draw up and create realities, or to appreciate reality, tell me what those words mean to you as you hear them again right now.
Well, I'm unable to separate poetry and faith. And poetry has been, throughout a lot of the periods of my life, and even now sometimes, the main way that faith is sustained in me, the main way that I feel God's presence. And that has really troubled me at times, because I thought, why? Because poetry can be lonely. And it has troubled me, but I feel reconciled to it now. I say this is only inherent to me, that poetry and faith are raveled together. I actually think it's true of every poet. Marina Sotayeva, I quote her in the introduction. She says all poets are Jews. And what she meant by that was that all poets are displaced and in exile. And it's been my experience that all poets are believers, even when they declare that they're not at all, or they're atheists or something. But there's something in the nature of poetry itself that calls us into a further existence. And I don't know, even someone like Wallace Stevens, who said that he was an atheist, he would say a statement like, if you do not believe in poetry, you cannot write it. And what does that mean, to believe in poetry? Mm. How's that different than believing in God? In the realm of primal words, we're always in tautology again, mm-hmm. I think. But yeah. for me, the two are in stuff.
I immediately think of, when I hear you talk about all poets are believers, I associate that with T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets and seeking a greater communion, a deeper union, and the kind of movement of that, the belief of that, and the poet's attention to depth, attention to particularity, and maybe Hopkins' dappled things. Glory be to God for dappled things. That mysterious intrusion, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about mystery and the role of mystery in your approach to poetry and faith.
Well, I think in that passage, I was writing about A.R. Ammons, but I was talking about myself and or about the way inspiration works. And it has been my experience that I mean, I know nothing about poetry. I know nothing about how it comes. I know nothing about, in terms of writing it, I can't plan it. I can't make a poem happen. And when it happens, I can't control where it's going to go. I don't know how it's going to end. Half the time, I don't even know what it's saying until I finish the poem and I look back and I say, oh, that's what it was saying. Mm. And I'm just following the music of it, or the thinking of it, or the intonations, or it's a very physiological thing. So it is a great mystery to me how they get written.
That also sounds like improvisation.
Yeah, there's a lot of improvisation. Yeah, a lot of improvisation in it. Yeah, definitely. You have to really trust the experience. You have to really trust yourself and the language and reality. And so it's very mysterious how these things get, how they happen, these poems, but also what they tell you, how you speak to yourself unconsciously, how it becomes conscious later, and how they tell you things that you believe that you didn't know you believed, or aspects of yourself that you didn't know you were there and didn't know were there, or most profoundly, aspects of existence itself. They tell you something about reality itself or about the nature of God that you don't contain. It's not in my head. There's no way that could have come out another way. It didn't come from me. It's not from me. It moved through me. You can't be proud of it. And so that's a kind of pure mystery at the heart of making that can certainly lead one to faith.
We'll be back with more from Christian Wyman in just a moment. Hello, listeners. We do not want podcasting to be a one-sided conversation. So let's try something fun. In 2022, we're going to roll out some experimental segments for the show, and they involve your voice. First, we're inviting you to office hours. Do you have a burning question, observation, objection, or just want to know more about a topic we cover? Simply record your question with your smartphone and send us the clip by email at faith@yale.edu. This might surprise you, but a lot of professional podcasts, including ours, use smartphone audio for guests. We'll review your questions every week and include your voice on the show before we discuss, either with that week's guest or Miroslav Volf or a friend of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Second, in keeping with our purpose to help people envision and pursue lives worthy of our humanity, maybe you have a way of articulating an answer to that question that's worth sharing. If so, send a 2-minute clip of yourself tackling life's most enduring question. What does it mean to live a life worthy of our humanity? We'll give it a listen and then share with all the other listeners of the show. This is our way of calling out from the podcast cave in hopes of getting a response from outside the echo chamber. Happy recording, friends. Now, back to the show. Wendell Berry talks about what is inward turns outward, as does, we're told, the kingdom of God. So we contain that which contains us. And I think this is very evocative of what you're just saying. If that's true of the kingdom of God and the kingdom of God in us, let's follow that up with this quote from Barry's Long-Legged House. So here in the place that I love more than any other, the one I've chosen among all other places to live my life, I am more painfully divided within myself than I could be in any other place. And of course, the context of this is he's reflecting on the history of that place. Right.
And what his forefathers have done. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not a complacent or sentimental vision of home that he has when he says the way is not a way is not a way, but a place. I mean, it is hard won, and he's filled with guilt and remorse for everything that is sort of lies behind his existence.
Yeah. I mean, whether it's stripping the land from the indigenous peoples that were stewarding it and caretaking it, or stripping the land of its natural resources and destroying it, or whether it's now seeing it as not a place at all, but just raw material that we can abstract from and mine and to be sold.
Yeah, that's what I really admire about his work, is that, like the line that you quote, that which is within us contains us. That's a great definition of home as well as God. Uh-huh. But that is, he sets that exactly aside our life in the world, which is rapacious and violent, and it is the antithesis of that kind of spirituality, spiritualism of home. But he doesn't shirk any of that.
I want to turn to another bit of improvisation, I think. Let me just find the page. This is Carson McCullers. There's nothing that makes you so aware of the improvisation of human existence as a song unfinished or an old address book. And that unfinished nature of poetry, the feeling that even that a life as you and I live it, as we experience the day-to-day, the quotidian, it's an unfinished work. It's constantly improvised. And in that sense, I really love the ways in which poetry is reflective of that lived human experience.
Yeah, I mean, I thought when I was young that everything was going to resolve into some kind of focus, or you're going to be able to stand on the mountain and look down and there would be your life all laid out. And you would understand how everything was knit together or worked towards making you the person that you are. And instead you look back and it's just chaos.
Right.
And it just seems to, and if you try to impose, I know we all impose a kind of meaning on our lives when we tell the stories of ourselves, but I think they're mostly false. I think it is mostly bewilderment that we come to. And a lot of it's been improvised. And that's Carson McCullers' point. I think an awful lot of it's been improvised. There's a poem in here by Kamau Braithwaite, which feels like an improvisation. A Caribbean poet, and he has this series of poems that are based on musical figures or musical instruments, but they're all bits of jazz-like improvisations. And this one is called Bass. Bassie the bassist loves his lady, hugs her to him like a baby, plucks her, chucks her, makes her boom, waltz or tango, bop or shango, watch them walk or do the dango, Bassie and his lovely lady, Bassie and his lovely lady, like the light and not the shady, bit by boom they build from duty, humming strings and throbbing beauty, beat by boom they build this beauty, Bassie and his lovely lady. I think that's just wonderful the way he does that. That's a man playing a bass. That's what's in the poem. And it's the music conjuring this whole relationship and feeling.
Yeah. And you feel it in the rhythm. You feel it in the resonance of all those voiced plosives. You feel its movement. And if poetry is a kind of respite, or a means of working out and improvising meaning as we go, and if it is for you in particular, a way of approaching perplexity and befuddlement and confusion, the tension that all of that offers, what is it about the reading of poetry that brings that kind of, well, I don't know if you would describe it as comfort, but what I'm trying to get at here is how is poetry in conversation with perplexity?
I think one of the best answer to that might be actually on the previous page of this book, in one of these prose interludes from James Baldwin.
Uh-huh.
And James Baldwin wrote this, my favorite short story in the world, called Sonny's Blues.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't need to tell you the whole story, but it's about a jazz musician. And and this is a passage from that story. All I know about music is that not many people ever really hear it. And even then, on the rare occasions when something opens within and the music enters, what we mainly hear or hear corroborated are personal, private, vanishing evocations. But the man who creates the music is hearing something else, is dealing with the roar rising from the void and imposing order on it as it hits the air. What is evoked in him then is of another order, more terrible because it has no words, and triumphant too, for that same reason. And his triumph, when he triumphs, is ours. So I think that's really it. That a really good poem, and it can be playful, perfectly playful, like this poem Bass that we just read, which is a poem I think about loneliness as well as about jubilation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone close to him.
It's dealing with the roar rising from the void and imposing an order on it. And that is both wonderful and terrible at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a deep consolation in poetry. It's not how all poetry works, but it's often how the music of poetry works. And that's what I respond to most deeply, is the music of poetry. I tell my students not to read poetry if they're in the room with someone else, because they ought to be able to, they need to read it aloud. They need to be to say it out loud, and, or at least to mumble. And it's the way I've always had to read poetry out loud.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense, even and especially when one's alone, but I think going ahead and reading aloud, even if you have to bug a roommate.
Yeah, that's right.
Invite them into the poetry. But you quote another bit of James Baldwin from Sonny's Blues earlier in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you quote, "While I was downstairs before on my way here, listening to that woman sing, it struck me all of a sudden how much suffering she must have had to go through to sing like that. It's repulsive to think that you have to suffer that much." So can you write poetry without suffering much?
Well, I mean, you can probably write some beautiful poetry. I think it needs to be abraded by life in order to become great poetry. And I think that's what Baldwin's getting at, that it is repulsive to think of some of the suffering that has brought forth some of the most beautiful works of art. And repulsive and also ennobling and hopeful that out of such suffering, such beauty could come. There's a poem on the facing page of this, which is by the Scottish poet George Mackay Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called "Old Fisherman with Guitar."
Yeah.
"A formal exercise for withered fingers. The head is bent, the eye is half closed, the tune lingers and beats. A gentle wing the west had thrown against his breakwater wall with salt, savage lament. So fierce and sweet the song on the plucked string. Know now for truth, those hands have cut from the net the strong crab-eaten corpse of Jock washed from a boat one old winter and gathered the mouth of Thora to his mouth." So in this poem, the very song itself is made possible by the physical existence of this person in this place. He's cut from the net, a strong crab-eaten corpse, and he gathered the mouth of Thora to his mouth. And those physical actions and experiences are in the sound. And according to George Mackay Brown.
Hmm. I wonder in closing here, if I might ask you a question that we ask most of the guests on the show. And in some ways, I think this comes back to the Van Gogh and the Bachelard quotes that we were talking about, especially the roundness of life from Van Gogh and the life that would be our own, that would belong to us in our very depths. And that's from the Bachelard. What is a life worth living?
Oh, for me, it's creating and loving, those two things. It's not a very original thing. But those two things can be in tension with each other, pretty severe tension. But I find that both those things, creating art and being able to love, being freed to love, are the two things for me that make a life worth living. The pursuit of God is raveled up with both of them. That seems to me the given in either of those things, at least in my own existence, that creating art for me is raveled up with the pursuit of God, communion with God. And love, however you define it, is also woven up with having a relationship with God. And so that's the given in those two things.
Hmm. Maybe we could end with a poem of yours. It's meant a lot to me, actually, for several years now. And it's "Prayer." A very short poem. And I've just come back to this poem in those times, those struggles with faith and doubt. I've just come back to it as a kind of liturgy.
Hmm.
And as an attentiveness, it feels, well, the poem itself is finished, of course, but insofar as it expresses a kind of moment, helps me to pay attention to the unfinished and the improvised in my own life.
Hmm. I'm glad to hear that.
Would you mind reading that to me?
For all the pain passed down the genes are latent in the very grain of being. For the lordless mornings, the smear of spirit words intuit and inter. For all the nightfall neverness inking into me even now. My prayer is that a mind blurred by anxiety or despair might find here a trace of peace.
Hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I've been wanting to hear you read that for some time.
Oh, no, thanks.
Where did that poem come from for you?
You know, it came in a whole flood of poems in a book called Once in the West. And I wrote them, almost all of them in my car outside of work. I would get there early when I was an editor at Poetry Magazine in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I would get there early and I was working in a fury. And then I was already on, I'd put it aside. But that's what I mean about a poem being a mystery. And I mean, I also really like that poem. I don't mean to. It's very close to me, and I sometimes say it to myself.
Mm.
But it's almost as if it was written by a stranger. To tell you the truth, I mean, it was there. It was very easy to write, and then I was just on to the next one.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's just a short, stark, bracing poem, really. Even in the construction of the stanzas, and just two words, sometimes one word per line, the movement of it, it's like a flash. Can't be just nostalgia that's distant. This one expression of that bringing close, the metaphysical reality that poetry can provide. Something's brought into being in just a flash. I mean, it's beautiful. Thanks for reading it.
Yeah, thanks.
Chris, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for your poetry and attentiveness and your thoughts on faith and life. I've enjoyed this conversation so much.
Me too, Evan. It's been great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured poet Christian Wyman, production assistants by Martin Chan, Nathan Jowers, Natalie Lamb, and Logan Ledman. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edit and produce the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, sometimes midweek. If you're new to the show, welcome, friend. Hit subscribe in your favorite podcast listening app, and we'd love your feedback. Ratings and reviews in Apple Podcasts are particularly helpful, but we're just as happy to hear from you by email at faith@yale.edu. We read each comment and do our best to respond and improve the show, bringing you the people and topics that you want to hear. And if you're a regular listener, it's a huge honor that you stick with us from week to week. So I'll ask you to step up and join us. Help us share the show. Behind those three dots in your podcast app, there's an option to share this episode by text or email or social media. If you took a brief moment to send your favorite episode to a friend or share with the world, not only would you be supporting the show, you'd be sparking up a great conversation around stuff that matters with people that matter. Thanks for listening today, friends. We'll be back with more this coming week.